Trigger warning. This case deals with violence against a child.
This is the Crimecasters Network with Alicia Sophias and Ronnie Dahl, two rogue reporters breaking newsroom rules to take you behind the crime scene tape.
Cheers, Crimecasters. Today's case involves a missing little boy and a trusted radio reporter who was covering the story until he confessed to killing him. And Alicia, we're talking about someone that worked at your former station.
Yeah. Have you ever heard anything like this before? It's a shocking story, and I can't believe it hasn't gotten more attention. The story of two-year-old Matthew Morby, a sweet little boy who vanished. And believe it or not, even though there was that confession, the case is still unsolved. Let's go back to the mid-90s. Things are not going well on the relationship front for 17-year-old Julie Williams in Fresno, California. Okay, most teenagers have tumultuous love lives, didn't we all? But Julie is well beyond that. She's been through a lot in her short life. At 17, she has had two children and has taken out protective orders against three different boyfriends. These three men will come into play here: James, Alan, and Jesus. First, James Morby, her childhood sweetheart.
Julie was born in California, but her parents moved the family to Washington when she's in middle school. Right away, she meets and starts dating James. They are quickly inseparable, doing the typical middle school things together, and then some.
Mm-hmm.
At just 14, she gets pregnant. They hide it from their parents until they can't any longer. When Julie's mom and stepdad find out, well, you could imagine, they're not happy. Julie and James are scared, but they're excited. And on August 19, 1993, their son, Matthew, is born.
He has the rosiest cheeks, red lips, and huge blue eyes. You can see this picture on our website. To them, he is perfect. It's not all roses, though. The family drama heats up. Plus, the new parents are trying to juggle school, a social life, their relationship, plus, oh yeah, raising a baby, and boom. By the following year, they are fighting a lot, and Julie asks a Washington court for a restraining order against James. Things calm down, and the two try to remain civil for Matthew's sake. And even though they aren't together, they throw him a first birthday party at James's parents' house. 2 days after that, fearing his parents may try to get custody of Matthew, Julie takes off with her son back to her hometown of Fresno. So James is out, and in comes a new boyfriend, Alan Taylor.
Julie is 16. Alan is a year older, and she tries to get her life back on track. She enrolls at Hoover High School and lands a spot on the JV softball team. She has hope of a promising future for her and Matthew. Now, her mom, Jackie, is helping to watch him, and so is Alan. He even brings little Matthew to some of Julie's softball games so they can cheer for her. But that spring, Julie gets pregnant again, and her relationship with Alan heads south. That summer, a fight between them gets physical, and she gets an emergency protective order against Alan. That's it. They are done.
Maybe. It's fall now, and like everyone in the Central Valley, Julie heads to the big Fresno Fair. It's a staple in that area, Ronnie. Everyone goes.
I love the fair, by the way.
Yes, you grew up in a small town, so you get it. But like, yes, literally everyone goes. And Chicken Charlie's, where they deep fry everything. Yeah, that's my stop. Anyway, at the fair, Julie meets Jesus Padilla. He's in his early 20s, and the two start dating. He helps support pregnant Julie and Matthew financially, and the two even move in with him. The following January, Julie gives birth to her second son, Cody. His biological dad, Alan, wants to see him, so he goes to court to get visitation with his newborn. Oh, this leads to a shakeup. Julie leaves Jesus and gets back together with Alan. As you can imagine, this is not a smooth transition. Jesus is upset and hurt, and according to Julie, dangerous. She says Jesus threatened to hurt her and Alan, which results in a temporary restraining order on Jesus. Now, that is number three, if you're keeping count. You may think this is the worst it can get for a teen mom, but it's not even close, because less than 2 weeks later, on February 6th, 1996, 2.5-year-old Matthew Morby disappears.
Here's how it plays out. Julie and Alan, back together now, are at her cousin's apartment helping them move. Julie and Matthew take a nap together. They are on the futon in the living room. Alan is like, I'm bored, and goes for a walk. It's about 12:45. When Julie wakes up around 1, Matthew is gone. And of course, she freaks out like any mother would do. Alan gets back from his walk around the same time, and he's like, well, Matthew was here when I left. So they search, but the boy is nowhere to be found. It's time to call police.
You know, this isn't just a case of a kid wandering away, because according to Julie, Matthew isn't wearing shoes or socks. He's in PJs, so he couldn't have gotten far without someone noticing. For police, right away, this is serious. So they launch a huge search. But by the next day, still nothing. So police use all of their resources, search dogs, rescue crews, and the media. When local TV stations air Matthew's adorable pictures that night, the community is all in. By the next day, everyone knows Matthew Morby's name, face, and they want to know where this angelic-faced boy is.
Detectives quickly learn all about the drama in Julie's life and work hard to sort through it. But really, their focus is on finding Matthew. Local news reporters are on it too, interviewing neighbors and tracking down the leads. The works. We've covered these stories. Mm-hmm. It is all in. Mm-hmm. The Fresno Bee devotes pages to the story. Its reporters hit it from every angle.
And my old station, KMPH, which had a news radio station back then, is all over it. Now, with radio, it's easier to provide updates all day long, and they do. On the second day, detectives are desperate to find Matthew, even though they don't think it's going to be a happy ending at this point. And they are right. During a helicopter search that morning, they spot something in the lake below. It is the body of little Matthew Morby. And Ronnie, at the time, news stations were taking this live. So the community actually saw what we all saw. The body of little Matthew Morby, and it's straight out of a movie. He is drifting in the water surrounding the Japanese gardens in Woodward Park, which is this beautiful, quiet place. There's vibrant flowers and a small waterfall. People go there to meditate. And then there's Matthew in his red plaid pajamas, floating on his back, his arms and legs straight out. He looks almost peaceful.
To give you a reference, it's about 2 miles away. So if he had somehow walked out of the apartment, someone surely would have seen a little toddler in plaid pajamas wandering down the street. Quickly, investigators determine his cause of death. They say he drowned in the lake water.
This is interesting because the medical examiner can actually tell if a victim of drowning struggled at the time of the death. I didn't know this until this case. Or if, you know, they had been knocked out already and just inhaled the water in. Now, in this case, they determined Matthew did struggle.
Oh, you think about his last moments.
Can't.
So, of course, it's now a murder investigation, and the main players here are all talking a lot to police, to media, really to everyone. Julie, though, is exhausted from not sleeping all week, and she's just crying all the time in public. Boyfriend Alan feels like he's a suspect. Hello. He says no one believes he and Julie didn't do anything to Matthew. And Jesus is in the mix, too. He's supposed to be in court a week later to see if the restraining order against him that Julie filed is going to be permanent. He thinks he knows who did this.
We'll get to that in a minute. And James, Matthew's dad, could not have done it. He was in Washington, and he only flies back now for the funeral. Speaking of the funeral, it is held on Valentine's Day. Hundreds of people in the community come to pay their respects because Matthew has touched so many people's lives. 1 week later, it's the start of polygraph season. I say that because everyone is taking them over the next few months, culminating in a dramatic finale. I'm relying on the Fresno Bee's timeline on this one. So, Ronnie, knowing what you know about the case and everyone out there listening right now, I want you to all guess the results here. Okay.
I think I'm going to be better than other people as well, because when I work for ATF, the polygrapher's office was next door to mine. And so the third office would be where he would conduct the polygraphs. And
how interesting.
Right. You'd see everyone come in, they would always be nervous. So I feel like I have some inside knowledge. So,
well, we're going to test your skills. First up, Julie gave her polygraph.
I'm going to say she was probably inconclusive because of her state of mind.
Oh, you are right on. That's exactly what happened. Next, boyfriend Alan, who was bored and went on a walk.
He's lying.
Yeah, you're right. He failed. Now, because Julie was so emotional, she comes in and they ask her to clarify her answers of the first polygraph, so it technically wasn't a second polygraph, a partial. So what do you think happened this time?
I think she still probably failed.
She actually passed this time.
So mom's telling the truth.
At this time. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Now we have Jesus. What happened with his?
I'd say he failed.
So he was inconclusive on part, and then he did fail part of it. I'm just impressed all these people lined up for tests. Usually we're begging people to come in. Now we have Jackie, who remembers Julie's mom, Matthew's grandma. What happened with hers?
I'm going to say she passed because grandma wasn't around, was she?
She failed.
What?
Her husband, Julie's stepdad, I haven't really talked about him much, so I'll just let you know that he pretty much passed. He did have a few questions, though, that were inconclusive that detectives were a little concerned about. So it is now May 1st. Alan comes back. He wants another shot at the machine. How do you think that went?
Well, if you failed the first time, you probably failed the second time.
You are absolutely right. He failed the second as well. 3 days later, someone, as if it's not bad enough getting, you know, failing two polys, someone beats him with a club and calls him a baby killer while they're doing it. And now when I say a club, I mean that thing, you know, you used to lock your steering wheel with back in the day, the club. Remember that? Yeah. So
they were red.
Yes, the club.
Like that's make those.
I don't know, but it's heavy.
Yeah.
Someone beat him with it, called him a baby killer. Can you guess who did it?
Well, it's got to be someone connected. Who else? Like,
it was Jesus.
What?
It was Jesus and one of his teenage friends he brought along with him.
Yeah.
They beat Alan.
Well, that's not good for him because guess what? Now he is charged with two felonies. One of them assault with a deadly weapon. He thinks Alan is responsible for Matthew's death. And if we are just going by polygraph results here, well, there are so many suspects, but police are not going to arrest any of them for killing Matthew because in just a few months, this case is about to blow up and send shockwaves through the community.
And especially in my old newsroom. It's October 10th, 1996, and at KMPH, reporter and radio anchor Stephen Diddy has a tough day ahead. He has two assignments related to child abuse. First up, a hearing for a local teacher charged with molesting a child, during which he's acting weird.
Would you say weird, though? Come on. We're newsroom people.
Yes.
We've all acted weird at some point in time.
And you see a lot of weird things in the newsroom, you're right.
But what are you talking about weird?
Okay. Well, like he is sitting back in his chair. He's zoned out. He's not really paying attention to anything. It's so weird. This may give you an idea that the photographer at the time actually puts the camera on him and starts rolling, probably to show the assignment editor or the producer later, like, what the heck is Steven doing? Now, Steven is supposed to go to a child abuse conference next, but back in the newsroom, he tells my former boss, Roger, you know what, I'm not feeling well, I need to go home. Okay, let me just put this into perspective, because if I had ever walked up to Roger and said, hey, Roger, I'm going home in the middle of a busy news day, he would have laughed at me. So I may have to call him and ask him about how Stephen was able to get out.
You better be in an ambulance, just so people know.
That's exactly how it goes, yes. But he allows Stephen to leave. And 2 hours later, Stephen is at the police station, something to the effect of, hey, I want to talk to someone about a child death case.
Now, if you or I did that, they'd probably be like, okay, you know what? You need to call the PIO. That's the public information officer. I used to be the PIO for ATF, so the call would come to someone like myself.
Right. And we would, you know, that'd be totally normal. Or they'd ask, hey, what story are you working on? When's your deadline? We'll try to put you in touch with someone. But Stephen is like, no, 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 you don't understand. And everyone at home, please sit down if you're not sitting down. This man, this reporter, confesses to killing 2-year-old Matthew Morby. I still need a deep breath all these years later.
I'm shaking my head, but when police call a 9:30 news conference at night, everyone knows something big is happening. Then they announce there's an arrest in the Morby case, which is what everyone has been waiting for, but then they announce the name.
I remember some of my friends in the newsroom who knew him before I got there said, when they said the name, they actually broke down and cried. They were in total disbelief. We could do a whole episode on this, but 2 days later, a judge formally charges Stephen Diddy with murder with special circumstances because of the kidnapping. That means it's eligible for the death penalty back then. Listen, things are not adding up, though. Even though police say that Stephen knows things only the killer could know, we hear a lot of things as reporters, like behind the scenes, so that could explain it. No one outside of this investigator circle believes Stephen killed Matthew.
I think I would be in that camp as well. It's crazy because there is also no evidence that he was there. Add to that, a mental health issue comes to light, but prosecutors actually schedule a trial. Stephen is found incompetent. He heads to a mental hospital for treatment, and 5 months later, prosecutors dismiss the charges, but they keep it open to charge him again if new evidence implicates him. Here's the problem. What do investigators do? They were headed in one direction, then got blindsided with this, believed he did it. Now, they aren't so sure.
Yeah, who is sure? Is it back to square one? It kind of seems like that's what happened here, because as of today, Matthew Morby's murder is officially unsolved. And his father, James, says it is time for some answers. This is still so raw for him. Hear his emotional plea to solve his son's case next.
You're listening to Crimecasters Network.
We sit here 25 years later with no arrest in Matthew's case. It's hard to even think about what his parents have gone through all this time. And I can tell you, Julie and James have both had a very rough life since then. James will be the first one to tell you that he tried to escape by turning to drugs, which led to addiction problems and even a stint in prison. This almost destroyed him. But he has other children and was able to get on the right path for them and to honor Matthew's memory. The one thing he wants more than anything to this day is to find out who did this to his son. Let's go back to 1996. Washington police show up on his doorstep one day to tell him his son is missing. Here's James Morby.
And they're like, well, he's been abducted and she thinks that you had something to do with it. And I was like, what? Like, no, that's not even true. She's the one that took him from me. And, you know, it's just been, you know, hell from since then.
I mean, you and Julie were so young when you had Matthew. And that's already a struggle. But then you add in everything that happened after. And it was just a mess back then.
Yeah, we were just turning 14. Seventh grade summer, and she was pregnant, And I mean, we were both scared to tell our parents, and you know, it worked out for the better, you know, for the moment until his first birthday. And then from then on, it was like, you know, I didn't see him again until I buried him.
My goodness. We all have that image of Matthew with his huge smile and those rosy cheeks. I was saying he has like bright red lips and like beautiful eyes with these thick eyelashes. What was he like as a child?
He was always a fast getter. I mean, he was always trying to do things so fast that it's like he knew that he was going to be gone and that he wanted to get as much done as he could in that shorter period of time. It was weird.
Right when this happened, police all of a sudden get all of this information about different people that were involved in your son's life or had access to your son. And it quickly got pretty dramatic.
I was hearing like 9-10 different stories of what could have happened or what did happen and this and that. And it's just like from news broadcaster people, from the cops, from the family, from this and that. It's just, it was a wreck.
You obviously became close with Julie again after this happened. What did you guys talk about? Did you point blank ask her, who did this? Do you know who did this?
Yes, I did. But on the other hand, I don't know if you believe in brainwash, but Julie actually brainwashed me into believing that nobody else that she knew had something to do with it, or, you know, that she didn't know anything. And you know, there's no way in heck that she does not know something. I mean, throughout these years, it had to be someone close to her, period, that did this.
You believe Julie knows something but won't say anything?
She has to. I mean, you know, throughout the years, you know, I've talked to her here and there, and she always still says, James, I love you, this and that, you know. There's something that she wants to tell me, but she won't. I want to get it out of her, you know, and I can just feel it. You know, she was my high school sweetheart or middle school sweetheart. I mean, my first love. And I can tell, even though we have been apart all these years, she knows something.
Let me ask you this. If the person who hurt your son is watching right now, what message do you have for them?
Why?
Why would you do it to a little boy for no reason? Why? I mean, and how could you be so sick and not come forward? If you're going to do something like that, why? Why?
When the news anchor, Stephen Diddy, walked in and confessed to killing your son, what did that do to you? What did you think?
I was thinking, who the heck paid him off to say this? Because there was no way that he could have done it. And in my head, he was the news broadcaster for my son's disappearance. You know, so there was no way he could have did it.
Are you confused by all of this?
Yeah. I mean, it's got me so stumped. I sit at night sometimes and go through the stuff that I remember and just try to put things together like a puzzle, but it's like it's missing pieces and I can't figure it out.
Must be impossible for you. I want, before we go, to talk again about Matthew. What are your memories of him?
I just remember him always playing and laughing and, you know, jumping all over the furniture and, you know, I don't know, he loved our dogs. You know, it's just, whenever I see a little kid that age, I fall in love with him.
Have you told all of your other children about Matthew?
Oh, yeah. They look at my arm right here. This is Matthew's picture right there. You know, they always pull up my shirt. Sometimes they cry, or sometimes, you know, my two youngest daughters, they lost their mom about 5-6 years ago, and we go to the cemetery and we talk about their mom and their brother, and you know, or at night we look at the stars and we pick a star for our son, my son, and yeah, they know everything.
What do you hope out of this?
I just want whoever to come clean. I mean, the, you know, my son, no kid deserves this. No kid. I mean, it's, I don't care what anybody says. No kid in this world deserves to go through what my son did at all. And I just want justice, and I want someone to pay for this.
Continue the conversation with your hosts, Alicia and Ronnie, on any of your favorite social media platforms. Find us at Crimecasters, and let's talk true crime.
Now is the time of the show where we go off script and have the real conversations we have while we are investigating these cases. And just off the top, I have to say, your heart goes out to James.
I mean, it's just a tragedy on so many levels. And, you know, James is not going to give up until he finds out what happened. And I have to say, out of all of the cases that we've covered, James is the most persistent. He's checking in all the time, and he wants to know what's going on. And I think that says a lot when a parent is still this devoted to the case.
You have to have someone be an advocate.
Right.
For the person that is no longer here. And that's why I think he is going to get the answers that he deserves one day. But I think I know, who does he think did it?
Do you have someone in your mind you may think did it?
Listen,
he has a few theories, but in his heart, he believes it was Alan. And there are a couple things here. Okay. There's always so much drama hiding behind all of these stories. But this one is, he believes Julie holds answers. So you know how I said she passed the second poly when she clarified her answers? He doesn't think she would pass one now because he doesn't think she was involved. But he thinks quickly after she learned what happened and was trying to protect those closest to her. Right. We'll get into all those players in a second.
Because I'm confused by the grandmother. Why would she fail?
Okay. And there were all sorts of allegations of abuse with mom and stepdad, including when Julie was pregnant. Apparently some physical abuse from stepdad during that time. They really did not want her to have a child at such a young age. They're deceased now. Mm. They're not around to answer the questions. But the people closest to this case say they were not the best parents. Let's leave it at that.
So what does Julie say? Were you able to reach her?
As you know, we tried multiple times to reach her, and James did reach her. He has spoken with her, and she just says it's too hard for her to talk about it. But definitely, we need to hear from her, you know? That's the one thing that's going to spark this, because now let me tell you another tragedy. She's been through a lot. We know that. This is enough for one person to deal with. But then add on top of that, her son Cody, the one that we talked about who was a baby back then that mm-hmm. she had with Alan, he recently died of drugs. And it was a rough time leading up to that. Now here's some back, you know, some information that we hear, that behind the scenes stuff. James said he had a conversation with Cody before he died, and Cody told him that he knew his dad, Alan, did it, but that he would never snitch on his dad. He would never go to police, and he would lie about it if anyone asked him. James swears up and down that he had that conversation with Cody, and he begged Cody to say something. So in his heart, James believes Alan is responsible. Alan failed 2 polygraphs. Alan had opportunity. I mean, what do you need in a case like this? They seem to be going down that path. Police will say they were going down that path. And then, I know we're going to get to him in a second, but then Stephen Diddy disrupts everything. And so what do you do? Where do you go from here? Is there a chance, even if you have evidence against someone, a good defense attorney, you don't think they can turn that around to leave a little reasonable doubt, like, hey, everyone, I know it looks bad for my client, but a trusted reporter confessed to the murder. And not only did the person confess, the person was charged. A murder trial date was set.
Right.
It wasn't like they looked into it and they were like, I don't think he did it.
And where is Stephen today?
Oh, strap on your seatbelt, Ronnie. Okay. So a few years ago, I'm talking 2014, he made headlines again. He was substitute teaching in the Fresno area and had an episode.
What do you mean he was a substitute teacher? I mean, I know there's a crisis right now, but hello?
He was teaching for 7 years, actually, leading up into this.
What?
Yeah, substitute teaching in the same district, in the same community.
That's what's hard to believe, because you have background checks. Or just do a Google search.
Right.
I mean, I know it was a while ago, but they still had Google.
Let me tell you what happened first, and then we'll tell you how he got there. So according to media reports, he was in class. He started saying bizarre things to the students. He was acting strangely again, to the point the vice principal called police, and they took him to the mental hospital and put him on a 2-day hold. Well, when parents found out who the teacher was, they did what the district probably should have done, right? They looked up all the information. They want to know how he could have been cleared, just like you. This man had been charged with murdering a child in the same area just years ago. Now, the superintendent at the time said, listen, all of his screening came up clear because the case back then essentially turned into a medical case, right? And that's protected under HIPAA. So they weren't able to discriminate, air quotes, discriminate against him for a mental issue. My thing is, if he would have confessed and they would have found no evidence at all of him doing anything wrong, and they never charged him and they never set a trial date, then I absolutely agree that he should get help for his mental health issue and be able to live a normal life, not having that be held against him. However,
if you have a felony on your record.
Well, it wasn't a felony.
With the murder.
But he was never convicted.
No, but I mean, even if you're not convicted, if you're charged, it comes up.
Even that long later?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
so, shame on the school district, but it's like you said, he needs help.
Right.
He needs help, and you're teaching kids. And I just think about, Alicia, how that confession sidelined this entire investigation. Would they have been able to get a conviction?
I know. And let me tell you, take you back to the newsroom, because this is the story that, you know, when you get hired at a new news station, they kind of give you the lowdown, like, here's all the gossip. This guy dated the weather person and this, you know, you like yeah. get all the gossip. One of the first things that I was told by our main anchor, who is my good friend, she said to me, yeah, just so you know, like one, because we used to have to work radio also. We had TV and we had radio, and we would walk back and forth and we'd have to anchor and report at radio during the day. So we were double duty. And Steven used to walk over and do stories for TV also. So one of the first things she said to me was, by the way, one of the last people with your job confessed to murdering a case that they were covering. Now, leading up to his confession too, he had been anchoring the newscast over at radio in the evening, and he was doing hourly updates about the Matthew Morby case. And then for some reason, he walked in and confessed. Can you even imagine what went through everyone's heads when they hear about the arrest and they're sitting there waiting to think it's like some monster? And it was a person that they ate lunch with in the newsroom. Like, how?
Because I've worked with several people that have since been convicted of crimes, and they've been in the news, and it's always a tap dance
to
how you're going to be covering it. And the scripts typically have to be scrutinized not only by the news director, but sometimes legal as well, like on a day of news story, that almost never happens. So yeah. I can only imagine. But, you know, the sad thing about this, though, is the case, like you said, is just it's unsolved.
I know. And I really think it's going to take someone coming forward, shedding new, you know, light on the case, saying what they know. Someone knows something. We always hear that. But in this case, it's absolutely true. And it's time.
So, of course, if you have any information about who kidnapped and killed Matthew Morby, call the Fresno Police Department. Up next, our true crime genius weighs in on this week's case and our closing arguments.
It's time to get schooled by the teen sensation of true crime.
Here's our resident boy genius with this week's sidebar.
My name is Ryan Kester. I'm an 18-year-old pre-law junior at the University of Texas at Dallas. And ever since I was 9 years old, I've been researching cases, attending trials, and poring over hundreds of thousands of pages of police documents, all in the name of true crime. On today's episode of Sidebar, we're going to be discussing something that almost never happens, the dismissal of murder charges. Literally, the two words are almost never in the same sentence, dismissal and murder. Obviously, in the case we're discussing today, it did, and that is exceedingly rare. It is almost unheard of for a prosecutor to file a murder case because that's the most serious accusation you can bring against a person, and then later decide not to pursue it in court. You can often see defendants pleading down from murder, say in the case of Crystal Lee Kenney from Colorado, who testified against her boyfriend, Patrick Frazee, in the homicide trial where he was accused of murdering his fiance. She very easily could have been charged with murder. She openly admitted to helping dispose of the body and clean up the crime scene. And under the law of parties, she absolutely would have been eligible to be charged with murder. Rather, she elected to testify against him, and any murder charges that were filed against her would have been dismissed. But the prosecution was still able to secure a conviction for him and for her, just for a lesser charge. It is very rare that you would see a defendant completely discharged from the legal system after being indicted or charged with murder. Very rarely would it even be reverted back to the police department, because generally speaking, if they've gotten to the point where they're comfortable filing charges, they're not doubting their investigation. It's more so that there's a lack of evidence, unless, of course, they're being forced to dismiss it due to some sort of legal constitutional violation or an issue with the defense's ability to have an impartial trial. But even then, judges will often use a dismissal as a last resort. That's just next to unheard of. Well, I have to go study for my exam because I really do not need to fail this class. So I will see you guys next week on the next episode of Sidebar.
Time for this week's closing arguments, and I'm going to take a little bit different approach this week, and I want to talk about some of the mental health issues that reporters and journalists do experience, because it's one subject that is so not talked about in the newsrooms. And for Stephen, he obviously had problems and probably had them for years, but what we cover, what we see each and every day can have a direct impact on how we live our lives. I don't know if that's what led to him to make this false confession, but I would plead with anyone out there, have a little bit of grace with him for doing such a thing, but also for all of the journalists, please take care of yourself. It's not weak to get help for your mental health.
That's absolutely right. And you know, Stephen was going through a divorce right before this all happened too. So I know that he had a lot of stressors. Thank you for that. I'm going to switch it up a little bit, and I am going to argue about who could have killed Matthew. And no, Stephen Diddy didn't do it. Of course, his father, James, did not. You have an airtight alibi. You are still aggressively pursuing answers to what happened, and we are right along with you. Mom, Julie, I do not think you did it. I'll circle back to you in a sec. Hey, Zeus, I'm not advocating you beating Alan because you think he killed Matthew, but I understand why you had such a highly emotional reaction. It also convinces me you did not hurt Matthew. I mentioned Julie's mom and stepdad had a bad reputation, especially stepdad, of being abusive to Julie. I'm talking severe physical abuse, according to James. And it doesn't paint a pretty picture. But he passed a poly, and he may have been a bad guy, but I don't think he was a murderer. That leaves Alan. Even his own son implicated him in this, according to James. You failed two polys and then stopped talking. I think you know something. Maybe it was an accident. Maybe you have a different story, but please come forward. And Julie, start talking again. It's time. Matthew needs justice, and you may be the only one alive that can still get it for him.
So as we do at the end of each episode before we sign off, let's take a moment to think about Matthew.
Yes.
And raise a glass. Hopefully you get the justice you so deserve.
Absolutely. I know you've been in everyone's thoughts and prayers for 25 years, and it's time for justice. We'll see you next week.